Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Hey everyone, welcome to Free For All Friday here on the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. And today we are talking about cheaters. Cheaters never prosper, except when they do. All the cheaters we're going to talk about today are people who did not prosper because they got caught, right? It wouldn't be a cheating scandal unless somebody caught them and then did the autopsy on what went wrong with their scheme. That's actually my favorite part of analyzing cheating and scandals, to see where the plan falls apart. So that's what we're going to talk about today. Monday through Thursday, we talk apologetics, theology. We have debates, dialogues, rebuttals. But Friday, we just get to have a little bit of fun and talk about whatever I find to be interesting. And so the genesis for today's episode was I was watching a documentary on the ASU point shaving scandal. So point shaving, and I'll talk about this a little bit here in a second, is related to fixing games. And I was familiar with the concept of fixing games, like when an athlete purposely loses a game in order to rig the results. But I wasn't as familiar with point shaving, that being a part of that. So the documentary is about Stephen Headache Smith and his involvement in the 1994 point shaving scandal. So I thought I would talk about that, as well as some other famous cheating episodes in sports and games. There's a lot of famous ones we're not necessarily going to be able to cover today. Maybe we'll cover them in a future Free For All Friday. But these I thought were fascinating, and for your personal edification, growth in general knowledge, and just fascinating subjects, we're going to talk about that today. So let's jump right in. The first one is the ASU point shaving scandal. This was back in 1994. Stephen Headache Smith, his nickname. Headache is spelled H-E-D-A-K-E. Stephen is spelled S-T-E-V-I-N, so whatever floats your boat, I guess. He was a professional basketball player for Arizona State University, a college athlete, and then he got involved in point shaving. And so what happened is that Smith was in some, you know, financial difficulty, and this does go back to the larger debate about paying college athletes. I don't know everything, all the arguments for and against either position, but I really feel like college athletes, college football players, basketball players, they generate so much money for these schools. It's a multi-million dollar industry that they're involved in. They're generating so much money, and yet they're not paid. I'm not familiar with their compensation. They're certainly not paid like people in the NBA or NFL or anywhere close to that. I think there are rules or bylaws saying they cannot be paid. And I think that's ridiculous. So some people say, well, they are paid. They get a free education from the school. Yeah, but they don't get a quality education. They take the easiest classes they can. The school babies them through to get their degree. And they're just used to make money for the school in athletics. And then when they're done, they're done. They either get drafted and they can go to the pros. Or if they don't, then they're kind of out of luck because they didn't really learn a lot in school. They didn't get a useful degree. And it leaves them vulnerable. People like Smith, who, if they were paid, maybe they wouldn't be tempted to do this, to be the target of bookies, people who control gambling and illegal gambling. Now, sports betting, of course, is not illegal, depending on the jurisdiction where you live. So what happened here is a bookie got Smith involved, and he was a very good basketball player, and he was, I don't want to say like point guard, but he was able to control the outcome of the game. So when you bet on, like, let's say a college basketball game, you're not necessarily just betting on who's going to win and who's going to lose. You can do that. But the other thing you'll bet on is the spread, like how many points are they going to win or lose by. There's going to be a favorite and an underdog. And you can bet how many points they're going to win, how many points they're going to lose. So what the bookie did was he told Smith, look, just you can keep winning games, because Smith said, I'm not going to lose games. Like, I'm not going to throw a game. He says, you don't have to throw a game. You just can't win by more than 6 points. So he would just bet on the spread, saying that ASU is going to beat Oregon, for example, and they're going to win, and they're going to win by 6 points and not more than 6 points. So it has to be somewhere between that window. And so Smith would go and he would play, and he would get it right on the money, winning only by 6 points. Though eventually he would get suspicious because he would miss shots. He wouldn't do well, though. At first, when he started off, he was it was very interesting. He minorly sabotaged his performance early on in the game and then came up strong at the end. So at the end, even if they won, but only by 6 points when they should have blasted the opponent, you hear the announcers say things like, ASU, terrible performance tonight, except for Headache Smith. He was great out there. So it's not as suspicious. At one point, the entire scheme almost fell apart when they were supposed to fix a game, and Smith rolled his ankle or twisted his ankle, and he thought he would be out of the game, but he just wrapped it really tight and went back out there and still got it. But he and the bookies that were involved, more people wanted to get in on it. And then people ended up analyzing the game, seeing like, wait, he's missing shots and he's having unusual behavior. There's an irregularity in the game. And then he was indicted for, then his, you know, his career eventually came to an end. He wasn't selected for the draft. And I think his bookie might have gone to jail. I don't remember that part of the documentary. Maybe I fell asleep. But Stephen Smith, point shaving scandal, very interesting. Reminiscent of one of the earliest scandals in American sports history, goes back to the 1919 World Series. And that would be the Black Sox scandal. Another scandal involving game fixing or purposely throwing games, fixing the games by athletes. It says here that the Black Sox scandal, a major game fixing scandal, where 8 members of the Chicago White Sox, those are the White Sox that were playing against the Cincinnati Reds, threw the 1919 World Series in exchange for money from a gambling syndicate led by Arnold Rothstein. And despite acquittals and a public trial in 1921, the judge involved, Judge Landis, permanently banned all 8 men involved from the White Sox from professional baseball. Punishment was defined by the Baseball Hall of Fame to include banishment from consideration to the Hall of Fame. People for decades have tried to get the players reinstated, including shoeless Joe Jackson from the 1919 Chicago White Sox. But at least up until today, the Baseball Hall of Fame has denied inducting them into it because of their involvement in the Black Sox scandal. All right, going to our next one is not sports so much, but game shows and quiz shows. I got 2 game shows on here to discuss. First would be the 1950s quiz show scandal. So back in the 1930s and 40s, when radio was really taking off, people loved quiz shows. So you'd turn on the radio and you'd listen to this old-time radio, and people would answer quiz questions. People have always loved game shows because you want to play along at home. You want to see who's going to win, who's going to lose. So that was a natural format when television began to take off in the 1950s, was doing quiz shows. Shows like the $64,000 question, which is where we get that phrase, right? That's the $64,000 question. That and 21 would be another example. You had to answer a certain number of questions and get to 21 points. And you played against someone else. You were both in soundproof booths. And you could stop the game if you thought you were ahead of your opponent after a certain point. But if you were wrong and you were behind your opponent would win the game. So it was a really neat game. You can check it out online. But during the 1950s, there were accusations, and ones that were proven, that these game shows were fixing the outcomes. So one was the show 21, as I said, it premiered in 1956. And the opening episode was just abysmal. They had 2 contestants, but the contestants didn't know like 80% of the questions, so they kept getting everything wrong. And so the sponsor of the show, Geritol, told the producers, you better not have a repeat performance like that, or we're going to pull our sponsorship. You know, the show's going to get canceled. So the producers felt like they're in a bind, like, oh, great, we have a game show. What do? Our contestants don't know any of the answers. So they eventually picked one contestant, Herb Stempel, and coached him to go on a winning streak. And because he was on a winning streak, people really liked the show. They wanted to root for him, and kind of like we do today with people who are on winning streaks on Jeopardy. But eventually, the producers of 21 found a new contestant that the audience liked better. He was a professor at Columbia University, Charles Van Doren, and he was just a lot more photogenic. Like, you look at Herb Stempel, he's kind of a dork. I mean, no offense, but he's kind of dorky, you know, and Charles Van Doren's like this hunky college professor type guy, very photogenic. So the producers wanted Van Doren to win the game. Now that it occurs to me, I might have covered this before on a Free For All Friday. If you're an Eagle Eye listener, you're like, Trent, you already talked about this. Well, that was probably like 2 years ago. After 500 episodes, we might revisit a few topics, okay? But I just think it's just fascinating. Then they told Stempel he had to throw the game because, they had coached Stempel all this time. His time was up, and now it was Van Doren's turn, and he had to take the fall. And so he purposely got a question wrong on a movie that had won the Best Picture Academy Award for that year. And it was actually, he had said previously, it was his favorite movie, Marty. But he guessed On the Waterfront instead, which was the Best Picture winner for the year prior. And he lost the game. But then eventually Stempel, I think he came forward to a journalist. But other evidence was amassed. And when all that came together, there was a court case. It was a 9-month long New York County grand jury investigation. There were no indictments that were handed down, but a congressional subcommittee investigated the issue. And that led Congress to amend a 1934 act in the year 1960 to prohibit the fixing of quiz shows. No, this ended up, because of the scandal in the 50s, quiz shows, fell out of favor in the 60s and 70s when it came to game shows and things like that, and didn't pick up really until later in the 80s and 90s, especially when you had Jeopardy and things like that, to try to take away from the stigma involved in them. Speaking of quiz shows and cheating, we have another one here, though. This does not involve the producers. This involves just three intrepid players fixing the game. And so while we're on the subject of quiz shows, I think one show that really brought back the quiz show format was Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Do you remember that? Of course you remember that. I'm Regis Philbin. Who wants to be a millionaire? Right, and the lights would come down. It was all epic. I remember staying up at night with my parents. I mean, that was in high school probably when it had premiered. And people loved it. I mean, it was a great show. You answer through basically 15 questions. And the questions, the money value increases. You start at like $100. Then, you get up to the $16,000 question, 32, 64, 125, 250,000, 500,000, and finally $1,000,000. And you can quit at any time or risk your money and continue on. And then it inspired, well, I guess maybe it came out in the late 90s, because the episode here, what happened here, this was on September 9th, 2001. Maybe you didn't hear about it as much because of what happened in the months following this event. But this is on the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire British version, the UK version or the British version. So because the show, it's gone all over the world with foreign versions of it. One appears in Slumdog. I love the one in Slumdog Millionaire. You ever see Slumdog Millionaire where the poor kid from the slums ends up on the Indian version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Hey, Chaiwala. You think you know the answer? Computer, lock is it, yeah. Answer C. He has done it, folks. And then later on, they accuse him of cheating and they're torturing him. How did you know that answer? they're torturing the kid. It's a great movie. But back to the British version. There's a documentary about it online you got to watch called Major Fraud. It's about Charles Ingram, his wife, and their friend, Tekwin Whittick, I think is his name. Tekwin Whittick. That sounds like something from Lord of the Rings. Tekwin Whittick. Or it's like something out of a Dickens novel or something like that. But I guess it's England, so what do you expect? So basically, Ingram ends up in the hot seat. And how he cheats is that Whittick, who apparently knows he is a really smart guy, but wasn't able to get into the hot seat. So how it goes when you play Once a Millionaire, right? You got 10 people on the floor and they answer one question. You got to do it real, real fast. The fastest person to answer the question gets to go and compete for the $1,000,000. Ingram goes up in the hot seat. First night, he does terrible. He looks like he's probably going to lose by like the $4,000 question. The next day, he keeps getting the questions right, but in a weird, weird way. He'll sit there and he'll talk his way around questions. Like, well, I think it's Craig Davis, maybe it's A1, or it could also be this person. And he would talk his way around questions in a weird way. I don't think it's Craig Davis. I think it is Craig Davis. I don't think it's Rome, not Paris. Maybe it's Barcelona. I don't think it's Barcelona. No, it's Barcelona. I'm going to go with C. And people are like, what is up with this guy? Like, He just never says how he knows an answer. He talks around it, feels uncomfortable, and then he keeps getting them right. And people are noticing, wait, something is wrong here. And then the producers are already suspicious of this irregularity. He wins $1 million. And they hear him and his wife arguing really loudly in the trailer afterwards. And it's like, wait, why are they fighting? He just won $1 million. And they're fighting, of course, because they had a cheating scheme and he was going to quit early on, like $64,000 or $125,000. But his wife is mad. He went all the way for $1 million. And now it's really suspicious. So they go back and look at the tapes and realize, wait a minute, Tekwin Whittick, who is sitting in the hot seat, who's sitting in the among the other contestants, when Ingram would recite answers, he would read them off and read through each answer. I don't think it's Rome. Maybe it's Paris. When he would say the correct answer, Whittick would cough. And then Ingram would listen for the cough. And there was actually one question that Whittick didn't know, and his wife did. And he said it, and his wife coughed from the audience and took a big risk to do that. Now, the thing I think about this scam is, why is Ingram up there? Whittick should have been up there. He actually knew the answers. He would have been smart enough just to win the game, honestly. Like, he just couldn't do the fastest finger round? Like, okay. So I want to play a clip here of it so you can hear the show. And this is a clip, a retrospective from Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, the English version, British version, UK. I know England, Britain, and the UK are three different things, but the across-the-pond version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, where you can listen and hear their retrospective and listen and hear to all of this coming about.
The plan was that Whittick would signal correct answers with a cough.
Yeah, I think I'm going to go for Holbein. I think if I had to guess, and I can, I think
can
I'd take cricket. I'm sure it's a hat. Am I sure? Yeah, hat. It's a hat.
So major fraud. Definitely check out the full documentary online. It's fascinating. Here's the last one. Let's go back to a sport. We'll go back to marathons. And this is the case of Rosie Ruiz, who cheated in the April 1980 Boston Marathon. And now, there's a whole bunch of people who have been caught doing things like this. There's a guy out there who has dedicated himself to finding marathon cheaters. So people try to cheat the marathons in all kinds of ways. Some people will commit bib fraud where they'll want to run in like the Boston Marathon, right? But to run in the Boston Marathon, you have to have a qualifying time, usually in other marathons. So what they will do is they'll pay somebody else to run with their race bib to get a qualifying time. And then they will run so they can say that I ran in the Boston Marathon or, you know, something like that. Other people will just, you know, the old fashioned way of cheating, right? Not run the whole race, like cut the race. And now today, they've got a lot of things. They got like GPS trackers, things like that to keep you in line. But this was back in the 80s. So what happened was that Ruiz appeared to win Boston Marathon female category with a time of 2 hours, 31 minutes, and 56 seconds. It would have been the third fastest female time in any marathon. But there were suspicions about it because people noticed Ruiz was not panting or coated in sweat. Her thighs were less lean and muscular than be expected for a world-class runner. She released her stress test showing a resting heart rate of 76. Most female marathoners have a resting heart rate in the 50s or lower. And it was an unusual improvement. It was 25 minutes faster than her time in the New York City Marathon 6 months earlier. And people asked, like, you didn't seem really tired after the race. So what was going on? She said, hey, I just had a lot of energy. There's more suspicion, though. Some of the female competitors said it was odd that they asked her, what did you notice in Wellesley, the Wellesley suburbs, when you ran through there? And she didn't mention that a bunch of students from Wellesley College were out cheering the female runners when they went by, but other runners could not recall seeing her in the race. The eventual winner, Jacqueline Garreau, was told she was leading the race at the 18-mile mark, while Patty Lyons was told she was second at the 17-mile mark. Ruiz could not have passed either of them without being seen. Spotters at checkpoints throughout the course didn't remember seeing her with the group of women. She didn't appear in pictures or video footage. A photographer, Susan Morrow, came across Ruiz also and later said, yeah, I saw her. She was in the subway. And she said that she was an injured marathon runner. So she basically just hopped out of the race, took the subway to the end, hopped back in, and then everyone thought that she won. And then she was eventually caught. Later in life, she was arrested actually for embezzlement. For the real estate company that she worked for. This is in 1982. As of 2000, she still maintains she ran the entire 1980 Boston Marathon. So some people just can't give it up. She died in 2019. So there you go. Cheaters never prosper, except when they do. We won't do a show about the cheaters that got away. Maybe there's a way to talk about cheaters that got away with it. I do not know. But it's interesting, these formats. What's really interesting to me are the people who, I mean, there's people who say, yeah, you got me. But the ones who just deny it to the end, who have almost deceived themselves, I think that's fascinating. So, hey, thank you guys so much for listening. Stay honest out there, honest in everything you do. Honesty truly is the best policy. But thank you guys, and I hope you have a very blessed weekend.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.